You are listening to the weekly podcast of Journey Christian Church, located on 441, 1 mile north of Maitland Boulevard, 1965 Southwards Blossom Trail in Apopka, Florida. Our website, journeychristian.com. This weekend, we continue with our series called Life on Mission. Today, lead pastor John Hampton will be talking about what it looks like when the church really takes seriously the great commandments of loving God and loving our neighbor as ourselves. Our scripture text comes from Matthew chapter 22, starting in verse 36. Today's message is entitled, Serve.
Would you be mine? I don't know the rest of the words to the song, so feel free to sing along. If you'd be mine, won't you be mine? I have always wanted to pastor a church like this. So I'll put on my tennis shoes now. So won't you make the most of this beautiful day? Come on, John, get your shoes tied. Won't you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Please, won't you be my neighbor? Hi. How are you? You a good neighbor? I bet you are. You're special, too. Of course, you're little sinners, too. Turn to your neighbor and say, you're a special little sinner. Anybody watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood? Anybody see that? All right, okay, good deal. I don't know if you ever noticed, Mr. Rogers, he always tied his sneakers. I don't know if you noticed that or not. He didn't do the slip-on sneakers. He always took time to tie. That was not an incidental prop, by the way. That was done intentionally because he wanted to communicate he wasn't in a hurry. He did not rush time with his neighbors via television. Mr. Rogers helped us understand neighboring. There was a man named Dave Runyon who wrote a book titled The Art of Neighboring. And the catalyst for writing the book was a meeting that he was at with a group of pastors that asked the mayor of a rapidly growing city in Colorado, what's the best thing the church can do for our community? It's a group of pastors meeting with the mayor. What's the best thing the church can do for the community? What's our city need the most? And the mayor said, it's pretty simple, really. The biggest single factor by far that makes a city flourish is when it has a sufficient number of good neighbors. The elderly are cared for, at risk kids are encouraged, property values increase, crime goes down, volunteering goes up. He said most of our city's problems could be reduced if our city had really good neighbors. The mayor went on to say that people call him all the time, say, you ought to start this program, you ought to start that program. But the mayor admitted something hardly any elected official will admit. He said government programs aren't always the best solution to social issues. What? He said finding the money and quality people to run the programs isn't easy. And then the mayor made this profound statement. Here's what he said. Relationship always trumps programs. Relationships always trumps programs. He said if churches were really interested in making a difference in the community, they should teach their people, You should not teach that. You should teach your people how to be really good neighbors. Now, Mr. Rogers was on to something, but correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Jesus say something about being a good neighbor? I mean, I distinctly recall Jesus saying something about this. In fact, I think this was a pretty big deal to Jesus. It seems to me that this was not a peripheral point that Jesus just kind of inserted into his teaching. It seems to me he gave this quite a bit of airtime. One day, a religious leader comes to Jesus and he says, Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus replied, Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Now, that's a pretty safe answer to give. This is taken from one of the most sacred texts in all of Israel. It's found in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. It goes, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." This is the first prayer that a young Hebrew learned. This is a good and safe and expected answer. But then Jesus, because he's Jesus and he loved to do this sort of thing, he added another statement like an amendment to it. And he said this, and the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Wait a minute, where'd that come from? The guy didn't ask for the second greatest commandment. But Jesus is saying there is a secondary greatest commandment that naturally flows out of the first greatest commandment. Jesus is saying the greatest commandment is made real and made relevant by the second greatest commandment, and that is to love your neighbor as yourself. We can't appreciate what a shock this would have been in Jesus' day. I mean, who has the authority to amend the greatest commandment? It would be like someone saying our nation's Pledge of Allegiance and adding the words, "I pledge of allegiance to the United States of America and especially Central Florida." We don't have the authority to amend the pledge. But Jesus takes it upon himself to add an additional statement to the greatest commandment. Why does he do that? Well, there's something very important he's up to here. There's something that is an underlying theme throughout the scriptures that is always in danger of being overlooked. And that is this: love for God and love for people who are made in God's image are inseparably linked. That in fact, you cannot love God and not love people. So Jesus weds these two together in such a way that it revolutionized the world. Love for God and love for others is what your life and what my life is to be about. And at least one mayor in a growing city in these United States, 2,000 years later, said the best thing that could happen to improve the quality of life for its residents, the best thing that would help a city flourish, would be for there to have an explosion of good neighboring. And one pastor said to the group of pastors after the mayor left that meeting, he said, "Am I the only one here that's a bit embarrassed? I mean, here we are, pastors asking the mayor what we can do best to help our city. And basically the mayor says, you know what, pastors, it would be a great thing if you could just get your people to obey the second half of the great commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. That would be a really good thing if you could tell people to do that." I mean, could it really be that simple? Is it possible that Jesus gave the most simple yet strategic plan ever to impact our world? So let me ask this question. What would it look like if the church got better at what Jesus said mattered most? What would that look like? Well, let's ask each other. How you doing on this one? Are you a good neighbor? I want to take a moment to introduce you to a little tool. One preacher calls it the sheet of shame. This simple exercise is really just about you identifying the neighbors whose property adjoins yours, or if you're in an apartment complex, the people who are next to you or across from you. And the simple answer is, could you do that? Could you do that? Many of us would struggle to complete this, and I just want to say full confession here. I know I would. I know a few of my neighbors. But honestly, I don't know that I could fill this out completely. So here's where you live, and could you name the people that are around you? So if this is true of you like it is me, and you couldn't fill all those boxes in, the next best step to helping you live life on mission, now this is pretty deep, what I'm about to tell you. The next best step to help you live life on mission is maybe like learn the names of these people. Whoa. Huh? Just like learn the names of those people. To go from "hey yo" to "hey Joe," you know, it makes a big difference, right? Just a little thing. Now, all this brings up a really important question. This question's been bugging me for a while. I just want to tell you this. The question that used to bug me was a question that was asked about churches like Journey. And the question that was asked was this: if your church disappeared tomorrow from your community, would anybody notice? And that's a good question. I mean, like, if we weren't here anymore, would anybody notice? Well, I mean, that kind of helps you understand an external focus and its not just about us, it's about how we're helping the community, and we exist for those that aren't yet here yet. And so I think that's a good question. But that's not the question that's been bugging me lately. Here's the question that's been bugging me lately. If I, as a Christian, disappeared from my neighborhood tomorrow, would anybody notice? Wow. Now that bothers me. That bugs me. I mean, like, what impact am I having on those living closest to me? Who is my neighbor? And when I say that, I'm not saying that metaphorically. I'm saying, no, really, who is my neighbor? Like, do I know their names? Do I know anything about them? Do I care to know? So we're going to be looking today in our Life on Mission series. We're going to be looking at one of Jesus' most famous stories to help us understand neighboring and how it's connected to this next step in life on mission. The story's found in Luke chapter 10, and this is a story most of you have heard before, whether you read the Bible a lot or not, or new to church, or new to the whole thing. You probably have heard something like this. So here we go. Let's go through it real quick. On one occasion, an expert in the law, which would make him a lawyer. This is important to remember. Keep that, file that away right there. So the guy asking the question is a lawyer. Stood up to test Jesus. By the way, testing Jesus, bad idea. I think of the Jack Link beef jerky commercials. You know what I'm saying? Messing with Sasquatch. You see those stupid commercials, and they mess with Sasquatch, and he always hits them in the end. And messing with Jesus, testing Jesus, dumb move. Here we go. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Kind of a, he's a lawyer, transaction. What do I need to do? What's written in the law? Jesus replied, how do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. He put the two together. And Jesus said, you have answered correctly. And if Jesus had stopped there, this would be a very short lesson, and everybody would have went home happy, and we would have missed perhaps one of the greatest teachings of Jesus ever. But Jesus did not stop there. Jesus added, do this and you will live. Notice Jesus did not say, answer correctly and you will live. No, he said, do this and you will live. In other words, it's possible to give the right answers and live the wrong life. And for some reason, churches get confused about this all the time. We often think the most spiritual, godly, in-touch people with God people are those who can answer correctly. They know the right verses and phrases and prayers and principles, but that's not what Jesus said. The main thing to God is not correct doctrinal affirmation. The main thing to God is that you actually love. You love God with all your heart and soul and strength and mind, and you love your neighbor as yourself. So Jesus says, hey, you're a sharp guy. Go and do that, and we're good. But remember, what does this guy do? He's a lawyer. And lawyers love to ask follow-up questions. It's just in their nature. And this is where we would say, hey, just walk away, buddy. You tested Jesus. You came out pretty good. Walk away. But this lawyer can't leave well enough alone. Notice the phrase. But he wanted to justify himself. Listen to me. Testing Jesus, bad idea. Trying to justify yourself to Jesus, really, really stupid idea. So he asked, and who is my neighbor? Now, I want to tell you something. This next part I'm going to tell you isn't in the gospel records, so I'm going to fill it in for you. Jesus smiled when the guy said that and said, you really want to go there? I mean, really? And then Jesus said, just remember, you asked for this. Okay, that part wasn't in there, but I just want to tell you that. So instead of giving a direct answer, Jesus tells a story. Now, he did this often. Why? Answers have a way of putting people off. Stories have a way of drawing people in. Answers call for a counter argument. Stories stir up our imagination. Answers make us defensive. Stories open minds and possibly hearts. Answers can offend. Stories can inspire. Had Jesus just come out and said, bottom line, Samaritans are your neighbors, you need to love them, deal with it, his audience would have walked away. They could not hear that. And so Jesus does what nobody expects him to do. Jesus says, okay, it's like this. Man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes. They beat him. He went away. leaving him half dead. Interesting note here, by the way. Jesus does not tell us much about the victim here. Jesus never really said whether this was a good guy, a bad guy, whether he was at fault somehow, used poor judgment, irresponsible behavior. We don't know if he's Jew, Gentile, because it doesn't really matter. If we're going to be a neighbor, it doesn't matter how they got there, what their background is, what their belief system is. Listen, we don't get to pick our neighbors. We're just told to love our neighbors. Now, G.K. Chesterton once quipped this. He said, we make our friends and we make our enemies, but God makes our next door neighbor. Isn't that so true? We make our friends and we make our enemies, but God makes our next door neighbor. And he said, we have to love our neighbor simply because he's there. As with most of the scriptures, we've sanitized this story. The guy, stripped, beaten, half dead. He's in bad shape. Tim Harlow, the guy who wrote the book Life on Mission, that's a companion to this series, he tells a great story in the book, if you've read it. He tells about a farmer coming out of his field when the wagon pulled by a mule, and he comes on the main road, he's hit by a truck. The farmer's pinned under the wagon. His dog is seriously injured, not far away from where the farmer is. His mule hit by the car, is just knocked across the road in a ditch on the other side in very bad shape. The driver that hit them fled the scene. Several minutes went by, and then the sheriff comes upon the scene. Looking over the wreckage, the sheriff first went over to the mule, saw the mule had a broken leg, was suffering badly. So he just pulled out his revolver, shot the mule between the eyes. Then the sheriff then walked across the road, saw the dog's pretty bad off too. Dog wasn't going to make it, shot the dog too. The sheriff then approached the old farmer pinned under the wagon, asked how he was doing. The old farmer said, never been better in my life, Sheriff. I'm great. Unfortunately, when people are hurting, sometimes the last person they actually trust to help them is someone they ought to trust. And Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan is the story of the wrong person helping when the right person couldn't be trusted. That's really what the story's about. Guy's in bad shape. But then Jesus kind of says, never fear, because a priest happened to be going down the same road. And his Jewish listeners probably were thinking, lucky for that guy. And if the guy had any consciousness at all, this beaten up victim would have thought, oh, good, a man of God is coming to help me. This is going to be good for me. But like the sheriff showing up at the scene of the accident. But the priest, for whatever reason, decides not to get involved. He passes by on the other side of the road. It's a bit of a head scratcher. But the guy laying on the side of the road is thinking, it really must be my lucky day because now a Levite is approaching. And a Levite is like an associate priest. They weren't able to do everything the priest could do in the temple, but they could assist. They're kind of like a physician's assistant. They can do almost everything a doctor does, but not quite. But the priest, like the Levite, takes a pass on helping the wounded traveler as well. And Jesus, again, he doesn't say why. He just passes by on the other side. And by the way, these two guys represent organized religion. You do understand that, right? This is a priest and a Levite. This is the establishment. This is a religious leader's establishment. They represent that. Favorite writer of mine's a pastor named Gordon MacDonald. And Gordon tells a story of years ago flying to Minneapolis to give a speech at a conference in Minneapolis Convention Center. And near downtown Minneapolis, he says his taxi was stopped at a red light four cars back from the crosswalk. MacDonald noticed a homeless man lurching in between the cars in the middle of the street. And when he got to the front of the taxi that Gordon MacDonald was riding in, the guy fell, landed on his chin. MacDonald said this, I could hear the thud, his chin split open, there was blood all over the place. And Gordon MacDonald's a very honest writer. He says, I got out, I looked over the top of the door at this man laying 6 feet away from me, and these thoughts actually went through my head. Number one, I have on a brand new suit that Gail, his wife, just bought me. I can't afford to get it messed up. Number two, I have to get to the Minneapolis Convention Center to speak in 15 minutes. Number three, I'm in a strange city and I don't know what to do. Number four, I don't have any medical training. I wouldn't know how to help this guy. But MacDonald said, I wonder if underneath all that there wasn't a fifth thought. And here's the fifth thought. If you're dumb enough to get yourself that drunk in the middle of the day, why should busy people stop and help you? He concludes, I'm ashamed of this. I can't believe a Bible-believing Christian could find those thoughts in the filing cabinets of his soul. For a few seconds, those thoughts militated against any movement on my part, Before I could come to better senses, other people came rushing to this man's help, and I was able to get back into my taxi and go on to the convention center to speak about sensitivity and caring for the needs of other human beings. Isn't that stupid? No, Gordon, that's really not stupid. It's convicting, because we've all faced similar choices, and we've all quickly talked ourselves out of doing what was so obvious that needed to be done, and sometimes we've done it in the name of religion. Let me just say this to you. Religion can get in the way of obeying Jesus. It is weird how religion can make us say we love everyone in general, but no one specifically. So both the priest, the Levite, they pass by. On the other side, part of the answer, by the way, to the question, who is my neighbor, is literally, your neighbor is the person you'd have to walk out of your way to avoid. A bad neighbor is the one who has to go out of his way to avoid doing the right thing. So who do you literally have to walk across the street to avoid? God put your neighbors around you so that you could be a witness to them and not to walk on the other side of the street. They may be in your family. They may be in your neighborhood. They may be at your work cubicles around you. I don't know where they are, but listen, God's going to put them in your way. Don't worry about trying to find them. They will find you. In contrast, what does a Samaritan do? It starts with this little phrase. Everybody say that word. Saw. When he saw him. Reggie McNeil said, it's amazing what we don't see when we're not looking. It's amazing what we don't see when we're not looking. Good neighboring starts by seeing, and seeing not just what, but why. Well, why is the grass overgrown over there all the time? Well, why has the newspapers not been picked up from the driveway for days? Why have the lights not been on for the last week? And when he saw him, he took pity on him. What does it mean he took pity on him? Some translations say he had compassion. To have compassion means there are certain thoughts that went through his head, that ran through his heart. Certain questions need to be answered, like, what would it be like to be beaten, robbed, stripped, and left for dead? What will happen to this man if he's left alone? Couldn't I do something? What do I have to do right now more important than helping this poor guy? How did the priest and the Levite answer those questions? We don't know, but maybe they had thoughts like this. I wonder if those robbers might still be around here. You know, the Romans ought to post more soldiers to keep this road more safe. What are all those tax dollars going for anyway? Maybe when I get to the temple, I'll say a prayer for this guy. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, the Samaritan asked himself, what will happen to this guy if I don't do something? The priest and the Levite asked, what will happen to me if I do? And that is one of the defining distinctions of compassion. Jesus then goes on into great detail about what the Samaritan did as opposed to what the priest and the Levite did not do. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, poured on oil and wine, set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, took care of him. On the next day when he departed, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, said, take care of him, and whatever you spend when I come again, I will repay you. 3 very simple movements I want to give you can go a long way towards serving our neighbors that we can learn from the Samaritan. First of all, stop. Everybody say that with me right now. Stop. The first thing we do is we stop. Instead of passing by on the other side, you've got to stop. Stop shows we're more interested in confronting the hurting condition of others than we are with protecting ourselves. So we stop. Popular business author Jim Collins writes, during my first year on the Stanford faculty in 1988, I sought out Professor John Gardner for guidance on how I might become a better teacher. Gardner was the former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. He's the founder of Common Cause, the author of several books. And Collins says he stung me with a comment that changed my life. Here's what Professor John Gardner said to Professor Jim Collins. He said, it occurs to me, Jim, that you spend too much time trying to be interesting. Why don't you invest more time being interested? Another man named Frederick Collins made the same point when he said, there are 2 types of people. There are those who walk in the room and say, here I am. And there are those that walk in the room and say, there you are. Stopping is taking the time to show interest in others. First you stop, then you drop. Does this sound a little familiar to you? Everybody say that word with me right now. Drop. And what do I mean by drop? I mean you got to get off your donkey. I like the King James translation of this a lot better. Some of you know it. That's what you need to get off of, okay? You need to get off of that. You need to come down off your high horse, and you need to be willing to get your hands dirty, and you need to be willing to get your hands bloody in this guy's case. So I stop and I drop, and some of you are thinking, roll, right? Like maybe roll out some cash. Maybe. But the truth is, it's easier to write a check to somebody in another country to take care of doing ministry rather than getting personally involved. So you stop, you drop, and then you do what you can. Everybody say that last phrase with me. Do what you can. I read about two women living in an inner city apartment building, and both were pregnant, living alone. And one day in a chance meeting in an elevator of their apartment building, one said to the other, I see you're pregnant and I am too. What if we exchange babysitting? In time, that simple neighboring encounter turned into 20 families becoming a neighborhood babysitting co-op started by just two single young moms living alone, trying to do what they can. I read about another man who had no interest in spiritual matters, and he related casually to his Christian neighbor who lived next door. They talked over the back fence. They borrowed lawnmowers, typical neighbor stuff. Then one day it was learned that the non-Christian's wife was stricken with cancer, and 3 months later, she is dead. She died. This guy, the non-Christian guy, writes a letter. I want to read a part of it to you. He writes, I was in total despair. I went through the funeral preparations and the service like I was in a trance. After the service, I went to the path along the river by our house. I walked all night long, but I didn't walk alone. My neighbor, afraid for my well-being, I guess, stayed with me all night. He didn't speak. He didn't even walk beside me. He just followed me. And when the sun finally came up over the river, he came over and said, let's go get some breakfast. The man concludes his letter by saying, I go to church now, my neighbor's church. A faith that can produce the kind of caring and love my neighbor showed me is something I want to find out more about. I want to love and be loved like that for the rest of my life. Just one neighbor, just doing what he can. I mean, nothing heroic, nothing big, just one small act done with great love. Two more things I want you to notice quickly from this passage, then we'll wrap it up. First is this, the Samaritan stopped and dropped and did what he could, and then he went on his way. In other words, he didn't stop his life. I think what Jesus is saying here is being a good neighbor is not about emptying out your bank account trying to help somebody, or more importantly, it's not about taking responsibility for someone else's life. You're called to be in a neighboring relationship, not a codependent relationship. But the second important phrase is this, when I come again. In other words, he didn't just write a check and walk away. He stayed in contact. The Samaritan is not a drive-by do-gooder who drops into a community and then disappears. He's going to remain in relationship. Listen, the context for our mission of witness is relationship. Never forget that. And like the Colorado mayor said, relationship always trumps programs. Being a good neighbor is always better than a good program. Always. Then Jesus concludes by asking this great question, as he asked so many great questions. Which of the three do you think was the neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? And the lawyer, remember our lawyer friend, the lawyer says, the one who had mercy on him. I want you to notice he can't even bring himself to say the Samaritan. He just mumbles the third guy. What Jesus says next is the important part of the story. He says, go and do likewise. Go and do likewise. Be my witness in Jerusalem and on the way to Jerusalem and on the way back from Jerusalem and along the road of your life, be like that guy. Stop asking, who is my neighbor? And start asking, won't you be my neighbor? You see, Mr. Rogers was right, but he got the whole idea from Jesus. We don't want to be a church that just gives right answers. We want to be a church that goes and does. Now, some of you say, here's some of you say, I need to just address this before we leave. Some of you say, you know, I have a neighbor who doesn't want to connect with me. They don't want me to serve them. They don't like being my neighbor. And frankly, I don't like being their neighbor. What do I do with them? Well, that's a really good question. And there's actually some wisdom about dealing with a difficult neighbor found in the scriptures. This is from the book of Proverbs. Look at this very quickly. Proverbs 27:14. If you loudly greet your neighbor early in the morning, he will think of it as a curse. Did you know that's in the Bible? What does that mean? In other words, don't force your mood or your disposition or your position on your neighbor. You've got to figure out what your neighbor's willing to receive from you. And if your neighbor needs some space, give them some space. Don't always be in their face. Love them from a distance. Pray for them. You know what? They can't do anything about that. It's been said people may refuse our love, reject our message, but they're defenseless against our prayers. And prayer is so important that before we wrap this Life on Mission series up, we're going to spend a whole message just on prayer. Some people will close you off because they're too busy. They're too scared. Their plate's too full. Maybe they're afraid of being exposed. There's an old country song that says, no one knows what goes on behind closed doors. And there's a lot of closed doors in our neighborhoods, and there's a lot of stuff going on behind them. And it's easy to label our neighbors as we drive through the neighborhood. There's the lazy neighbor who never cuts their grass. And there's the hoarding neighbors that's got junk sitting everywhere all the time. And there's the annoying neighbors with that demon-possessed dog that won't stop barking. But what's going on behind closed doors is a neighbor who's going through a devastating divorce or a bitter custody battle, or a neighbor who's reeling from a diagnosis of cancer, or a neighbor who has a drinking problem and they don't know how to stop, or a neighbor who's been cut off from her family, or a neighbor who just lost their job. In other words, there's a neighbor who's probably a lot like you. And you never know when or where a neighbor breakthrough might happen. You know that? You never know when or where a breakthrough might happen. You know, the final moment of Jesus' life was spent on a cross between two thieves. Jesus' last neighbors before he died were two guys on death row. And one of them wanted nothing to do with Jesus. And sometimes that happens, even with Jesus. But one guy not only defended Jesus, he appealed to Jesus for mercy and forgiveness and for something better than he deserved in the life to come. And Jesus saw him. And he had compassion on him. And he told him he would remember him. He said, right now, we're neighbors in death, but in a little while, we're going to be neighbors in paradise. And moments later, Jesus' spear-pierced heart stopped. And his thorn-bearing head dropped. And Jesus and his outlaw neighbor rolled into glory. And Jesus is still looking for neighbors to love. And that's the movement we get to be a part of. The mayor said it. Mr. Rogers made it popular. The master commanded it. And we just need to obey it. And you know what we'll discover when we do? We will discover that Jesus' great command meets the world's most urgent demand. Jesus' great command meets the world's most urgent demand. Would you stand with me right now? Let's stand together. Father, I thank you that we are just reminded again of a very simple but powerful truth. Everything you've said and everything you will say is suspended and summarized in those two statements. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. On this, all the law, the prophets are fulfilled and completed and summarized. And you are that King. And you've said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Father, we do love you. And we want to show that love is real and relevant by loving our neighbor, who may be very different from us. But I'm reminded again that people liked Jesus who were not like Jesus. I pray, Father, that we might just be reminded that we may pick our friends and we may make our enemies, but you pick our neighbors. Teach us to love them. Teach us to serve them. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this message, Serve, with Lead Pastor John Hampton. For service times and more information about Journey Christian Church, please log on to our website anytime at journeychristian.com or call 407-88-GRACE. That's 407-884-7223.